Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Mark Sheland. I'm Director of Programs here at the Middle East Institute. It's a pleasure for us to host today's expert panel that will examine the policy options confronting the Trump administration in Afghanistan and Pakistan. As we start, I would ask again, those of you sitting at end seats, if you see interior seats open in your row, please consider shifting over one or two to help us accommodate the late arrivals. This event has been made possible through the generous support of the Lewis R. Hughes Lecture Series at the Middle East Institute. Mr. Hughes is a member of our board, and we thank him very much for his engagement and steadfast support to MEI. We are recording today's event for posting on the MEI website in both video and podcast form. With that in mind, we ask you to silence your handheld devices. For those of you visiting us in this venue for the first time, welcome to MEI's temporary home. Our building around the corner on N Street is under renovation. As that ambitious project moves forward, MEI is comfortably housed here, and we'll convene our public events in this modest ballroom, and we look forward to seeing you here often. In fact, your next opportunity will be later this month. On Tuesday, the 21st of March, we anticipate a speaking engagement by the Secretary General of the Arab League, Ahmed Abul Gheit. Please watch for that announcement coming up on our website in the coming days. Do register and attend. We look forward to seeing you. It's now my pleasure to introduce the moderator for our discussion. You have his bio and those of our panelists on the flyer that you picked up on your way in. I will say simply that Dr. Marvin Weinbaum is director of the Center for Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois, where for a decade and a half he directed the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern studies. He has worked in government as an intelligence analyst and has authored or edited numerous books and journal articles. You find his work now regularly on our website, mei.edu. Marvin will introduce our panelists and the topic and guide the discussion from now until 1:30, and there'll be ample time for your questions. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for braving the elements today and joining us. Please welcome Marvin Weinbaum and our panel.
Thank you, Mark. Is this working? Yeah, yes, it is, yes. It's a great pleasure on my part to be able to convene this panel with a distinguished group of panelists, certainly people who are going to contribute to our understanding of what has become a very hot topic, if you will. The New York Times today lead editorial on what our policy might be, might not be in Afghanistan. Reports of late on what perhaps changes we should make in our policy towards Pakistan. Before I go any further, let me mention that we are operating under Chatham House rules to this extent that although we do have a camera back here, it's an internal camera. That means, of course, that if you wish to attribute any particular statement, you'll do so, I hope, with the permission of the panelists. Okay, so it's a topic which bears certainly a lot of attention, even though it did not get very much attention during the campaign, as you all know. Nevertheless, I think that the anticipation here, out there as well as here, that there will be a reexamination of policy, I think is certainly widely accepted. Let me quickly give you a brief introduction to the panelists, since you have a somewhat fuller biography from your program. Shamila Chaudhry at the far end. Shamila is currently with School for Advanced International Studies, Johns Hopkins, as an assistant to Dean Vali Nasser. She is spent considerable years in government, in the White House, with the National Security Council. She's been with policy planning in State Department and more, and she's certainly one of the city's experts on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And to her left is Jack Gill, and Jack is currently professor at Colonel Jack Gill, retired, is currently professor at the National Defense University, and Jack is part of the South Asia Center at the National Defense University. Jack also is someone who those of us who have been working in this area have known for a long time and value his comments. Lisa Curtis, who is well known also to most of you here in this room. Lisa is currently with the Heritage Foundation. And Lisa has, again, one of these lengthy lists of experience that she's had here in Washington in various capacities. I knew Lisa from INR. Lisa was also active in policy, state policy, policy planning. And other agencies. Lisa, we value her being here because she may be one of the few Republicans among us, which immediately elevates her, I think, to a particular place of interest here. But so I hope I didn't embarrass you, Liz. And finally, Dan Feldman here to my right. And I want to say first, Dan is with the law firm of Atkin Gump. It goes on, but I'll leave it at the short version of it. And Dan has been involved as the assistant, came on as deputy to Holbrooke, remained in that position for a number of years, and the biography does not have the fact that Dan succeeded as a special representative from 14 in 14 and 15. So add that to his credentials here. That was a omission on our part. Dan has continued to remain involved with the area, fortunately, and so we're also going to get the benefit of his insights and experience in working with Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the format is this. I'm just going to raise some questions and elicit comments, and we'll have discussion around each of the questions, and we'll move on to the next question. And we'll take about until 1 o'clock or so to do so, and then give ample time here for you to ask questions, because we get complaints often enough that we don't give enough time for that, but we're going to see if we can accommodate as many as possible. Let me say that there are still seats down here. I see two in front of me here. I see two more over there. So please, take this moment before we get started to be seated. Very well. Well, let me start off with what is the obvious question, then, is do we need a comprehensive review now of our policies towards Afghanistan and Pakistan? When the Obama administration came in, we did get that, certainly, for Afghanistan. Is this time for it, and why? Dan? Well, no, we won't go down. I'm just going to recognize people as they show their interest in wanting to make comments.
Sure, I'll say. Well, first of all, thank you very much to MEI for hosting us, and it's fantastic to see such a full crowd here. I had no idea that this many people were still interested in Afghanistan. It's very heartening, and Pakistan, to see that. In many ways, it has become the forgotten conflict and forgotten region, so the fact that there is still significant interest in what our options are and where the region is going is very important. And obviously, it's great to see many of our former colleagues in the audience, many of whom could answer these questions as well or better than us. So I hope that it leads to a robust discussion later. In terms of the specific question on should there be a comprehensive review, I would say absolutely, unequivocally, in a very heartfelt manner. Though it's a criticism, I think, frequently of Washington that when you have a problem, you hold a meeting and schedule a review. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely necessary at this stage. Having been an alum, as was Shamila, of the very exhaustive review that was done at the beginning of the Obama administration in 2009, those they're frequently difficult and painful, but the process of getting to some decisions, I think, is quite important at the beginning of an administration, especially, I'd say, this administration, where the nature of the interagency decision-making is still so unknown and relatively opaque. But I think there are some really significant issues here, particularly in Afghanistan, but in the broader region. 16 years into U.S. engagement after 2001, to try to define exactly what our national security interests are in Afghanistan. Is it still primarily counterterrorism? Is it a broader regional interest? Are we engaged there only because we've invested so much already with some notable successes, but also not to the degree that we'd initially hoped? And we don't want to see the backsliding on key areas of concern, especially successes in areas like women's empowerment and the progress of girls and social service indicators on longevity and education. And so what is driving our interest here? And it's something that, as you noted, there was very, very little attention paid to this over the course of the campaign. And so we have no real sense from President Trump on where he stands on Afghanistan. I think he called it a mess in 2015, but said he would begrudgingly still leave troops in. But to what end? And I think as part of this, especially for an administration that defines its equities and priorities so significantly through a counterterrorism, counter-extremism prism, exactly what is the threat emanating from Afghanistan and from the region? Is it a direct threat to our homeland? Is it simply from the Taliban? Is there truly a growing ISIL or Daesh presence there? And if so, does that threaten us? And does it necessitate more engagement there? What does it mean for the rest of the region? And the one thing I would say specifically on a review is that it truly must be a comprehensive interagency review. This should not be simply driven by a troop-level number coming from the DOD, which is effectively what I think the nascent review that's starting is right now. And we've seen, obviously, in terms of General Nicholson, General Botell yesterday, talking about a modest request for increased troop presence, whether U.S. or NATO partners. It appears that that's still very much in the train, advise, assist mode. But even if we're talking at the high end of another 5,000 troops there, that brings us to roughly 18,000 at this point, where we had a high of 150,000 international troop presence in Afghanistan several years ago. And we still have an ongoing insurgency. Every military commander that has been there has said this conflict will not end through military means alone. There has to be some sort of negotiated political settlement. And if that happens, that cannot be solely driven by military. So to have a true interagency review with what are the equities of diplomacy, of economic issues, of development, how do you engage the region most proactively, how do you engage the Taliban at some point, and put that in a broader context of what are our interests and what does that mean for the military piece, that review, I think, is desperately needed, and I hope that's what we ultimately get.
Lisa.
Yeah. So thank you to the Middle East Institute, to Dr. Marv Weinbaum for hosting this event. Thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to see everybody here despite the bad weather. So I absolutely agree with Dan that we definitely need a review of the strategy toward the region, toward Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it does need to be a fully integrated strategy, while a decision on troops, if we're going to increase slightly the troop levels, may be the most immediate decision that needs to be made. It's certainly is not the only decision and should not be made in isolation. And it's very important to have the State Department weighing into this overall strategy, talking about a diplomatic strategy, both in terms of how to engage the Taliban moving forward, but also a diplomatic strategy toward Pakistan and how do we more closely align Pakistan's policies toward Afghanistan with U.S. objectives. And of course, the aid strategy is extremely important. We're probably operating in an environment with less resources, so there will have to be a very close look at what are our aid programs, what is most important, how are we going to limit opportunities for corruption and waste, which there's been far too much of over the last 15 years. But let me talk about the stakes, because that's important. You know, we're saying we need a review strategy. Well, why do we need a review strategy? And the stakes for U.S. national security in this part of the world are very high. They remain high despite the fact that we have not been able to fully stabilize Afghanistan. That doesn't diminish the fact that we still have critical national security interests in the region. And the security situation is dire. The Taliban has made territorial gains since we ended combat operations in 2014 and reduced our troop levels. And if the trend lines would continue and the Taliban would make more territorial gains, you're providing an opportunity for Al-Qaeda to revive itself. And you're also giving a morale boost to Islamist extremists across the globe. Right now, a lot of the attention is focused on ISIS in Iraq and Syria. But the fact is, Afghanistan and Pakistan remain major fronts in the global fight against terrorism. General Nicholson indicated in congressional testimony recently that 20 of the 94 U.S.-designated terrorist groups reside in this region. And all you have to do is look at the major attacks that this region has experienced in just the last month. To know how volatile and dangerous it is. On Wednesday, you had a major attack against a military hospital in Kabul, over 30 people killed. In Pakistan, last month, you had a string of attacks culminating in an attack against a Sufi shrine in the Sindh province, which killed nearly 90 people. So clearly, this is still an area that needs and deserves U.S. attention and engagement. And I would just reiterate that this should be an integrated strategy, and we should not be seen as just focused on the military strategy. We should also indicate that we understand ultimately a resolution has to be a political resolution. But the fact remains that at this particular moment, the situation is not ripe for a negotiated settlement, that I think that we need to put more effort into the military situation in order to bring the overall situation to the point where the Taliban are ready for serious negotiations.
Let me add to the question. Well, as we talk about integrated strategy, should we be looking at a strategy or looking to review both Afghanistan and Pakistan to some degree together? That is, can we really review either of these apart from the other? Jack?
Yeah, let me start by saying thank you to MEI and to Marvin in particular. It's a treat to be here. I have to also begin with a disclaimer that I am a U.S. government employee. Please do not take my comments as representing anything other than my own thoughts. However, I do not represent any U.S. government agency in my remarks today. I would heartily endorse both the comments from Dan and from Lisa in the sense of the need for and utility of a review. Personally, to me, I would be surprised if a new administration did not conduct a review for an important situation such as this, where we have U.S. troops on the ground as well as important U.S. interests at stake, as Lisa has outlined. And I think General Nicholson in his testimony indeed suggested such a review. We also have at senior levels in the new administration a lot of people who have experience in either directly in Afghanistan, like General Nicholson and General McMaster and now Secretary Mattis, So there'll be a lot of folks who are coming to this problem with a lot of background and understanding and not approaching it new. Similarly, this needs to be, as both Dan and Lisa have outlined, across the United States government. If we are only within the DOD context, we're being far too narrow in my view, and in the context of U.S. interests. But I think I would also expand this to include our NATO partners and those other countries who have stakes in Afghanistan, in particular those who are contributing troops and are part of the UN mission and the other activities that are undergoing, that we're taking part in there. So this ought to be something that we're in some kind of coordination with those international partners as we look at this. So in short, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to have a new review, but that does not necessarily mean that we have to change. If there are things, pieces of the strategy that seem to be on track or going in the right direction, then we should not be afraid to stick with those, even if they are holdovers from previous administrations, be it the Obama administration or the Bush administration. And personally, I don't see a lot of big differences in your second question, Marvin, about policy goals between the current administration and the previous one. We might see less tolerance across the United States government for problems emanating from Pakistan. And I don't see how we can talk about Afghanistan without talking about Pakistan and without putting the Afghanistan in its larger regional context, including Central Asia, Iran, India, Russia, and China at a minimum. So that would be my thoughts on how we might think about approaching this, Marvin.
Yeah. Shamal.
Okay, so I'm going to disagree with my colleagues a little bit. I personally have a lot of review fatigue, and I know you guys do too. You're just being polite. We, as Dan mentioned, we did multiple reviews. Every time there was a major decision that needed to be made, there was a review. And what happened while those reviews were being conducted? My sense was that President Obama and his team already had a sense of what they wanted to do, and they made those decisions in the end anyway. Now, we have to ask ourselves then, what is the purpose of a review for any institution? Now, I work at an academic institution, and we do have reviews, and the value of doing something like that is to both identify kind of lessons learned from the past, what didn't work or what worked well, and then the second value of doing a review is for agenda setting and goal setting, okay? And if we take it in that context, we have to ask ourselves, do we know what the problems are on AFPAC? After 8 years of multiple reviews, multiple troop decisions, diplomatic engagements, do we know what the problems are? Does our bureaucracy have a good sense of that? I would say yes. And I would say yes 1,000 times over. And those of us who were in the system in the beginning and left the system at the end know that the people are much smarter about what the region needs, the challenges, where the policy works, where it doesn't. So we actually have built a pretty significant infrastructure to address what the problems are. What we don't have are any answers. And so that's what I think we need to focus on when we talk about review. Conducting an interagency review can be valuable in highlighting some of the existential challenges that still exist on AFPAC and then some of the policy management problems that we weren't able to accomplish in the past 8 years. So what are those things? And I want to be specific. I think one is what Marvin is alluding to is the AFPAC nature of the problem. You can't actually have a sound U.S.-Pakistan policy without looking at the war in Afghanistan. These are still linked. And how do you deconflict that? What needs to happen to deconflict that, if in fact you want to, and you want to have a relationship with Pakistan that exists on its own, and you want to have a solution to the war in Afghanistan? So I think that's still, we don't really have a good answer for that, and a review would serve that purpose. Two, the conflicts of interest when it comes to the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in particular. That impacts what we want to accomplish in the war in Afghanistan. We do not have answers for that, right? A review should focus in on those. Like, why are we in this situation with the Pakistanis? Why do we keep going back to square one if, in fact, we know what the issues are? And we've put a lot of money and diplomatic kind of engagement into this. Why are we still here? Why do we keep coming back to this place? And that's related to the next point I want to make, which is use a review to get at some of the policy management challenges or the changes in the bureaucratic structure that might need to be made in the State Department or in the USG. This is something that's doable, and it would show, again, or it would signal, like, this is what our agenda is going to be. We want to keep AFPAC together, or we want to separate them. That all sets, sends a signal to everyone who has stakes in this game. And then the biggest thing, which I don't hear this coming from us, what did we learn from our mistakes? And this is the thing I always think about when I'm in any job. What did I do right? Which you kind of get feedback on what you did right because that's what you're looking for. But you're never looking for feedback on what you did wrong and why. And I don't think that we've had an honest conversation with ourselves about that question. So I would hope a review would focus in on that. So related to what we learned and what we did wrong or what we could change, I think the two specific policy areas that demand review are the counterterrorism strategy, especially in light of what Dan mentioned, like who is the enemy now? What does ISIS in South Asia mean? There's the conflict in the Middle East, which is having kind of effects in the region as well, and that will shape U.S. AFPAC policies. All of that is related to our counterterrorism strategy, and we can only have a counterterrorism strategy if we have a certain kind of troop presence and numbers. So those two things are connected, and I find it highly unusual that the first thing out of the administration is a conversation about troop numbers when we haven't articulated who our enemy is. If you go back to all of the white papers that came out of the Obama administration, they focused on Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda leadership. They don't talk about Afghan Taliban in the way that we understood the conflict. They don't talk about ISIS. We have to review kind of that terminology and explain to the world, this is why we need 10,000 troops, or this is why we need 20,000, because we are fighting this enemy. And that answer does not exist for me yet. So I'll just leave it at there.
Thank you. Did anyone want to respond to that? Lisa?
Yeah. So, I would argue that the only way we can really have any hope of getting a handle on the terrorism threats in the region is if we find a way to limit Pakistan's ability to frustrate our goals in Afghanistan. And I think that something Shamila raised, this issue of how our relationship with Pakistan relates to Afghanistan, do we want to separate those? Shamila didn't say this today, but a few years ago there was this push that, Pakistan was the more important country, that, our stakes with Pakistan were, much greater than with Afghanistan. And therefore, we could not look at our relationship with Pakistan through an Afghanistan lens. Well, I would argue instead that, yes, Pakistan is an important country, but its dual policies towards terrorism should be the most important U.S. concern in the region if we're talking about getting a handle on the terrorism problem there. So I think that I would propose that as a starting point, we do look at the failure of our Pakistan policy over the last 10 years, because despite billions in aid, strategic engagement, that was the big idea with the Obama administration 8 years ago. I'm not saying that it was a wrong approach. I think it was worth trying, but it simply has not worked. We, 15 years later, we still have Taliban and Haqqani network sanctuaries inside Pakistan. So I think we do have to consider whether, in addition to inducements and engagement, we do need to think about consequences for Pakistani behavior. And, here is where I'd say we need a more clear-eyed approach on just how detrimental Pakistan's continued support for these groups has been to fundamental U.S. national security interests in the region. And we can get into more details on what that might look like, but I thought this was a good time to raise this issue, because Shamila talked about, what is it with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, and I think, it is the nuclear issue. That I think in the past, whenever we've thought about, imposing conditions or actually implementing conditions on Pakistan, you bring up the fact that Pakistan's a nuclear weapon state and that the conversation sort of ends. But I would argue that our counterterrorism interests in the region are so fundamental that we need to be willing to take some degree of risk in evoking a different Pakistani response. And I also, I that if we do take this more clear-eyed approach, that we actually will get further with Pakistan than we've been able to get in the past. I'm not saying things are going to change overnight, but I do think that we should be willing to take some of those risks and have confidence that we, you know, we can get more Pakistani cooperation than we've been able to get over the last 8 years.
You know, the Jack, you alluded to whether there was going to be a real difference here between this administration and its predecessor. I wonder whether that's shared here by other panelists. There clearly were foreign policy differences between the two presidential candidates, and so it raises the issue, is this administration likely to listen to different people? Does it come to the table here with a different set of overall objectives, or really is this in the end going to be, with some adjustment, really a continuation? Thoughts? Dan?
I think that the short answer is that I just don't think we know enough at this point. I think a lot of on the Afghan policy of this administration, a lot is trying to be divined by the fact that you've got General Mattis as SecDef and now General McMaster at National Security Council, and both with prior experience in Afghanistan, and so a general sense that there will be a commitment to at least maintaining a current footprint, if not increasing it. But that's all from, I think, kind of conjecture and speculation. Certainly, candidate Trump saying that he would begrudgingly leave troops there, but then also suggesting that, as he has in other theaters, that the international community should be doing far more. And you know, whether he spells that out or how he tries to make that case, especially if he's, you know, continues to alienate key partners that we've been reliant on, whether at NATO or the Australians, and specifically, I mean, I think that that's to be seen. On Pakistan, again, there's been virtually nothing said. I think many people have certainly overanalyzed this, you know, fleeting call between the president-elect at that point and Nawaz Sharif, and suggested that that the relationship will be stronger based on that. But I think that once it gets into a range of kind of policy issues, which have yet to be fleshed out, whether that's the counter-extremism in the region, whether it's the future of Afghanistan, whether it's the relationship with Iran on one side, whether it's Pakistan's relationship with China, and depending on where China goes, I think, let alone the Indo-Pak relationship, I just think that it will be subject to many other policy decisions that have yet to play out. I guess to go back to one of your questions on the AFPAC relationship and to try to bring in some of what Lisa has said as well. In my mind, and after having served as special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the countries are inextricably connected in terms of finding long-term stability in the region. But they also have to be looked at, I think, individually in terms of what the needs are and how we continue to try to identify and then address our key policy issues. So clearly on the Afghan issue, for all the reasons we've already said, I think there's a series of imminent decisions that have to be made, and the troop level number is just one of them. But I think also to be added into that is, you know, first of all, what is the nature of the long-term, if there is a long-term U.S. commitment to Afghanistan, as we've said in the past, what does that look like? How is it defined? The issues that Shamila raised on where exactly the threat is and where does it emanate from and what does it mean to us? But also, what does it mean in terms of what is our commitment to Afghanistan on seeking political stability, our engagement with the government, the role that we've played over the last few years and trying to continue to ensure that the government of national unity is functional and effective? What does it mean for economic sustainability and the role of the U.S. and the international community over many years? And most importantly, and perhaps we'll get to this soon, and what it means for trying to get at the most, the only effective long-term sustainable resolution, which is a negotiated political settlement with the Taliban, and how much emphasis will we put on that? How will we actually try to broker it? Who are the parties that should be involved in a range of other issues? Similarly, for Pakistan, I tend to disagree with Lisa's analysis about it being purely a failure. I think that what I believe in is that there are many, many equities that we have with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, all of which we've tried to address in some way or another. And certainly over the tenure of the Obama administration, we had highs of significant bilateral cooperation relationship with a strategic dialogue, with assistance, with a range of things. We've also had lows post-Islamabad, post-Salalah, where our relationship was quite broken. And in the past, obviously, we've gone through periods where we've cut off all assistance. In none of those have we necessarily produced an end result where we've been able to impact or change Pakistan's core strategic calculus, because Pakistan's core strategic calculus will be defined by what Pakistan asserts as its own needs for its sovereignty and its role in the region. And so I think the engagement with Pakistan and trying to develop and shape those with them, what does that mean for Pakistan's own counter-extremism issues internally, which pose a significant threat, and where we have overlaying interests? What does it mean for Pakistan's relationship with in the region, not just with Afghanistan, but India, China, Iran, and others? What does it mean for a nuclear program, where obviously we also have our own interests and where we've had some successes in continuing engagement? And so looking at it from through the prism of Pakistani interests and where those overlay with U.S. interests, I think, is where we're most likely to see some change. And then figuring out how we best nurture that and what the levers of U.S. power can be to alter those. And again, I believe that that's got to be as integrated an approach as possible. It cannot just be through a military lens, but through all of our levers, through economic through development assistance, but also through direct investment, through the role of our business communities, through people-to-people ties, through civilian and diplomatic and other efforts, and have everything and think about it as comprehensively and strategically as possible. But that's quite difficult to do.
What should we make of the role that American domestic opinion toward the region will have on the kinds of decisions that are likely to emerge here? To what extent does this set parameters? Or is this all going to be decided in a room somewhere?
I just want to say a few things on what Dan said. And this is related to domestic politics, but when we try to understand what the administration's view of Pakistan is, or Afghanistan to a certain extent, let's not forget to frame it in the broader political context of what the administration's message is of, making America great again, or retreating from engagements in the world, and in particular the administration's approach to the Muslim world. And I think that, we have to remember what it feels like to live in the Muslim world, and Pakistan is a Muslim country, and these ideas and words are resonating with them. I mean, they're going to be very pragmatic when they look at the Trump administration, but this does have an impact. And when I analyze it, I sort of see Trump and his team as having decided which Muslims are good and which Muslims are bad, okay? And for Pakistan's, luckily for Pakistan, they seem to be in the good Muslim category for now, okay? And that could quickly change, but that's a short-term benefit. But we should think about what that means. I suspect that Pakistan's relationship with the Saudis has something to do with it, and that will temper the Trump administration's approach to Pakistan, perhaps the prospects of business opportunities for Trump's family. I mean, we should be very honest about it. And that might be something that the administration feels like is workable, and that might be the reason for such a positive kind of tenor to that initial phone call. Let's frame it in that lens first and foremost. But second, like more realistically in terms of policy implications, the generals are going to be running the policies with these two countries. And Trump himself said it when he was asked in his press conference with Theresa May about torture policy. He said, well, I'm just going to let Mattis, he's the expert, I'm just going to go with him, but I do disagree with him. Okay. Now there's another general running the NSC now. So to me, it's very clear that this is there's a militaristic approach that's going to be taken to these two countries, and we're familiar with that. That's not foreign to us. We know what that is because that was very much part of the Obama administration's approach as well. It wasn't the only one, but it was part of it. So let's think about it in those lens. There is a danger to that, and we know what that is too, which is the U.S. military, when looking at Pakistan, if you're sitting in Kabul, you have a very distinct view of the Pakistanis. If you're sitting in Islamabad or in Washington, you have a little bit more positive view than those folks sitting in Kabul. That's going to be a challenge, and that's an old challenge we have, but I think that's going to emerge, and that will define kind of how the administration approaches these issues. And the old a strategy of, like, carrots and sticks, I think you're going to see that come out because there's still not agreed on which one works better. And so there's a clientitis in the U.S. system of, well, just let's throw more security assistance to the Pakistanis, and that's what's going to work. And to the extent that it's something like FMF and it benefits American defense industry stakeholders, I think that the administration would welcome that and would have no problem with that. I think that on the stick side, though, it's something that Lisa is alluding to, is that, you know, Pakistan's relationship with other actors and how that impacts American lives and American safety. And that's where it could get very problematic. And what do our generals think about that, and how would they manage those kinds of issues? So I think that's going to be the dominant way that this administration looks at the policy. The Kushner kind of Bannon wing that's really centralizing foreign policy, the most important aspects of it, I don't think they're going to pay any attention to Pakistan. It's not on their radar until it is, but there's no reason for it to be on their radar, even with the potential business interests. So I'll kind of throw those out there for the domestic angle. And then there could be an opportunity where Pakistan falls under the general kind of slash and burn agenda of the administration, slash and burn everything and cut costs everywhere. And that's where Pakistan could potentially become a real victim. But in practical terms, so much of the money that went to Pakistan over the past 8 years is in a pipeline anyway. And so some of that, I think, is guaranteed. I mean, some of that is probably getting tapped into for other emergencies around the world. But so there are costs, but I don't think that they're urgent and immediate.
Lisa.
No, I think Shamila characterized probably this administration's initial views on Pakistan pretty well. But let me just add, you know, when we're talking about U.S. public opinion, it's a lot different than, you know, 6-7 years ago when we had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan and you had very high U.S. casualty rates. Now, you know, that we're out of the combat role, you have a lot less U.S. casualties. So you're not dealing with that issue of public opinion. But now what I see as the biggest problems is the U.S. investment, you know, at this time of austerity and you know, focusing inward among the Trump administration, you know, how much are we going to invest resource money-wise into continuing the war. So I think that's going to be the hardest thing for the Trump administration to manage. But the fact that we do have somebody like General Mattis at the helm at the Defense Department, another General McMaster at the National Security Council, another general at Homeland Security, people who, you know, have all been involved in Afghanistan in one way or another, understand the stakes there, I think we can safely say that the strategy will be driven largely by conditions on the ground. You know, I think we can't deny that President Obama when he did talk, he didn't talk about Afghanistan very much, but when he did, it was usually about timelines for withdrawal. We were always talking about when U.S. forces would be withdrawn, when the drawdown could begin. And I think with the new administration, there will be a willingness to listen to commanders on the ground and not focus so much on withdrawal timelines, because I think our commanders on the ground had been frustrated by this approach.
A few points in response to a few things. Shamala raised a great point, which I meant to touch on as well, in terms of while we may not know where the policy distinctions of this administration may be from the prior one, we certainly know from some of the current initiatives that there could well be unintended consequences and ramifications in areas around the world, including in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so in particular, an administration that talks about and defines things so much through a prism of, you know, radical Muslim terrorism, violent Islamic extremism, all these issues, certainly during our time at the State Department, this was an issue that we always watched percolate in Afghanistan, Quran burnings in the U.S., which could lead to deaths of UN peace workers within hours, certainly if not days, of an incident that you would have no sense was coming, but would lead to kind of a swift change in public perception, and then some action that was directly counter to our own interests there. And so I do think that we will have to continue to look very carefully at what the reaction is of this administration to issues that have seemingly no connection. What does it mean if we actually establish our embassy in Jerusalem, and will it have implications in the broader Muslim world? What does it mean if we give up on a two-state solution? What does it mean if we continue to talk about these threats in this way and how that impacts our equities there? I absolutely agree with Lisa, having gone up on the Hill for 7 years and tried to get a continued share of a dwindling pie of assistance, that, you know, in general at this point, the U.S. population is just not focused on this. Once our troop numbers went down, they were out of direct conflict, and the casualty rates went down, there was a kind of there was a willingness to continue to spend a significant but not extreme amount on continued engagement to have a presence and to seek to stabilize. And I agree that the issue will be, especially at a time when you potentially be cutting state and aid by over a third, what does this mean for what we're actually able to do on the ground in Afghanistan? And what we do will have enormous implications for what our partners do. They're all looking to us for some initial decisions in terms of what their own military footprint will be, how much engagement they will take, what sort of economic assistance out of the most recent conferences at the EU and NATO last year will be the continuing commitments on both the economic and security side, what role they will have in reconciliation. But I think, again, this all gets to that first question, which is, to what end? What are we doing this for? And this goes to Shamila's question. My one differentiation with Shamila at the very outset is that we may all have study and review fatigue, and you describe the we who know the answers. I don't know if those are the we who are in decision-making positions right now in the White House and elsewhere. And so that does need to be informed. What are we hoping for? Some version of a long war, where by a modest increase in troops, or even if it stays relatively the same, if we have 10,000, 15,000 U.S. troops there for a decade or more, and that helps to stabilize it but doesn't get you much beyond the current stalemate, to what end? I mean, is that a goal in and of itself? Perhaps it is, but someone should hopefully decide on that before we embark down that path. Or do you take some variation of the Biden argument or at some point the Trump argument on what is our national security interest there? If we're not at war with the Taliban and there's actually not much ISIL threat there, and we've continued to diminish al-Qaeda and it doesn't pose a direct threat to our homeland, why are we there at all, and should we be leaving and thinking about having more effective use of our forces elsewhere? So that's why I think we have to get at those fundamental issues of, is the goal to get beyond stalemate? Is it for some sort of long-term political sustainability? And if so, can that be achieved militarily and how? And if not, then if we have an interest, how do we expect to get to that end point?
Marvin, just one.
Yeah, please, Jack.
Yeah, just one quick thought on public attention to this problem, which is very, very low and unlikely to change. So I would think that the administration would not be under a lot of sort of public focus or public pressure to address anything in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The public is likely to be consumed with domestic issues, immigration, healthcare, and on the agenda abroad, there are going to be things that are of higher priority and a lot more volatility and sort of excitement. Syria, Iran, Russia, North Korea, et cetera, will likely dominate, not Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I strongly agree with Shamila that these things could change quickly, and I would highlight three points. One is, I think for the American people, and I'm just speculating here, I don't have wealth of Pew research data to back this up, but my guess would be that if there's a sense of no progress and sort of endless bickering in Kabul, then that would have a deteriorating effect and a negative effect on American public opinion. The second thing that could change is the Hill and their perception on Capitol Hill of our involvement in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and particularly, I think, with Pakistan, as we've seen in the questions and whatnot that have been directed to the General Nicholson and General Votel in their testimony in the past month or so. And then finally, I think Shamila is quite correct in saying things could change quickly, which to me argues for the U.S. government not at the principles level, but at a lower level, being prepared in advance to at least think through some of the things that might change quickly and how we might, what the scope of our responses might be, so that when it does change quickly and you are called in to see the secretary or the national security advisor or whomever, then at least at some level, a fairly senior level of the bureaucracy, we've thought about it and we can offer something that is reasonable and thought through and adjust then only to the specific circumstances of whatever the event happens to be.
You know, as one pundit pointed out, not having committed to a policy gives you infinite number of options, whereas the Trump campaign took some very decided positions on what it was going to do and has to live with those. It doesn't have anything to account for as far as this region, which suggests that perhaps it will. It is in a position of not having dug its heels in on any particular approach. That would be if it's used well, that would be valuable. Dan pointed out, and I just wanted to emphasize that what we have to see this also in broader regional terms and in multiple regional terms. Our relations with Iran, you mentioned, Arab-Israeli, China, and other potential hotspots are going to have a blowback on this region, if only because we're talking about a broad Islamic region. So I don't know if anybody wanted to comment on that at all. Jack?
Well, I think this is a really interesting question. I wouldn't look at it so much as blowback. I would flip it around and say that what we want to do, what we decide our objectives, as my colleagues have pointed out, in Afghanistan and with Pakistan, there are other regional countries with whom we in the past have coordinated, and some of our colleagues here in the room have been involved in that, and with whom we might wish to coordinate in the future. And those include China, Iran, and Russia, and others. India it clearly has very important stakes from its perspective in Afghanistan. So if our policy towards those countries, China and Iran in particular, is very different in this new administration, then that could complicate our efforts to work with them, work with those countries, for mutual interests in as far as Afghanistan and Pakistan are concerned. So whereas I commented that I think if we just look at Afghanistan and Pakistan at the macro level, differences between the previous administration and the new one probably are not great. I mean, we'll see. If a review does happen, then maybe something will germinate from that. As Dan pointed out, you know, we're really operating in the dark to a large degree right now. But where that would be, where I would caveat that is Iran and China, where this administration might take a very different view towards Beijing and Tehran than the previous one.
Yeah. Smiley, did you?
Yeah. I take a very long view on regional engagement and kind of considerations. Part of the reason I feel like we're in this situation, and you know, we were at, when 9/11 happened, we were where we were because we didn't really have a permanent presence in the region, and we didn't. We were so in and out in terms of our policy engagements, and limited in terms of what we were focused on, which was security and some obviously covert cooperation during the Soviet invasion, and then we were out for about a decade. And it's not like the Middle East where we have an American presence post, or there's no kind of basing relationships in the region, and all of that actually facilitates a potentially dysfunctional relationship. And I do think we have to think about kind of how other countries look at South Asia. So we have to learn from how China is looking at South Asia, how the Iranians look at it, the Indians do. And of course it's their backyard, but it's actually our backyard now too, because we've been there for so long and we have 8,400 troops there, and we may have more. So I do think it leads us to this very important question, and again, it's not a specific question, but we have to ask it if we're doing a review, which is, would a certain number of troops actually advance U.S. geopolitical interests over the long term? And if so, what would those be? We don't actually have that defined yet, because a lot of our interests are still about al-Qaeda or Afghan Taliban focused. And so I think those are very important questions to ask in a policy review.
Just quickly, so talking about larger regional relationships, I think there is definitely opportunities for limited cooperation with China. What we've seen over the last couple years is that China is more willing to talk to us about what's happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I think they are increasingly concerned about instability in Afghanistan. You know, for so many years when the U.S. and NATO had a heavy troop presence there, there was always the complaint that, you know, China is outsourcing this issue, you know, they need to step up to the plate more. Now that we are drawing down, I think we are seeing China, pay more attention and try to get involved in helpful ways. And, you know, you can just look at the quadrilateral coordination group that was U.S., China, Afghanistan, Pakistan, trying to work on getting a reconciliation process going about a year and a half ago. Now, that was unsuccessful, but the fact that, you know, China was willing to kind of step in, at least get its toes wet in these kind of messy issues, I think bodes well for the future. And so I would say that there are still these opportunities to cooperate with China in limiting the terrorist threat coming from the region.
Clearly, there is no long-term sustainability without the buy-in and engagement of the region. So there have to be continued outreach efforts. But even more importantly, there is a role for U.S. leadership in this, and that is what I worry most about being absent in this administration. I completely concur, obviously, that China over the last 7 or 8 years has become more engaged in Afghanistan, but that also didn't happen in a vacuum. That happened because the first trip that Dick Holbrooke sent me on as his deputy was to Beijing with a group of about a dozen interagency colleagues to talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan with the Chinese. And at the time, they did not even want to have the words Afghanistan or Pakistan anywhere on the agenda. This was a broad dialogue about South Asia. And over the years, we engaged them over and over and over. We brought them into the international contact group. They started becoming more involved in reconciliation. They decided for the first time to start engaging on bilateral assistance projects with us in Afghanistan's interest, including the training of Afghan diplomats. And they need to be, and to the point where they actually hosted the Heart of Asia conference a few years ago, Ghani's inaugural trip as president, when they had been suspect, I think, of the entire entity when it first was founded a few years before that. Russia and Iran are developing by all reports, you know, significantly more deeper relationships with some aspects of the Afghan Taliban, remain quite involved in Afghanistan. Clearly, Pakistan's role will be critical to the future of Afghanistan, as well as the Indo-Pak relationship, as well as others in the Gulf. And Jack alluded to the fact that we've tried many formulations of the right parties. I don't know if we've hit on the right one yet. But we know the universe of actors that will be important. And in all of those, the U.S. has helped to play a leadership role in facilitating and convening and setting the discussion. And what's most concerning is that the most recent report of some of those regional meetings is that for the first time, the U.S. was not at the table. And so what does that mean about our ability to, again, assert our own interests, however we define them in this review process, and what that means for how we engage both on the specific Afghan-Pakistan challenges as well as the broader region?
We should open this up, but I just one thought on this, how important good diplomacy is going to play here. It seems that these intractable, in some cases, problems that we have are going to require this, and one would hope that the initial indications here of a sidelining of the State Department, I think I'm speaking maybe, I think that I hope will pass, because these are so much of what we've been discussing today is going to require the kinds of negotiating skills and depth of understanding of the region, which does not exist in all branches of government. So I'm going to invite now.
And again, our colleagues who've been in the Special Representative's Office and whatnot will have a better sense of this, but we've talked a lot about the military side, and because troop levels are measurable, it's a nice metric, and because the most recent testimony we've had in public has been from general officers whose job it is to concern themselves with that. But I wouldn't want us to lose the focus on what is probably the central issue, and that is governance in Afghanistan. And the importance of support for President Ghani's government and their ability to sustain themselves through this very difficult period for an extended period of time. So the centrality, I think, of governance in Afghanistan is should not be lost sight of, because it's so easy to say, well, it's 8,400 or 10,008 or 5,009 or whatever. That's nice, but the governance issue, I think, is really crucial, as Marvin, you know very well.
Yeah. Fine. So in asking your questions, please obviously keep them short, a single question, and do identify yourself. Okay. Gentleman right here. Do we have a mic? Or are we? Yeah. Please wait for the mic.
Hello. So my name is Sean O'Reilly. I'm with Search for Common Ground. My question to the panel would be, with that a diplomatic solution is necessary and that the military solution is not viable, what do you see the role for NGOs or Track 2 type diplomacy kind of filling in the void with the State Department being sidelined, and are there any avenues there that are not being pursued?
I've operated from the NGO world. I believe strongly in the role of NGOs. I think there are NGOs doing fantastic work throughout Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as the region. But they are not a substitute for the State Department either. I mean, just to echo what Marvin said, I mean, diplomacy has to be on equal footing with the role of defense, and including all other levers of U.S. power, including development and everything else. And for every reason, it's engaging with the Afghan government and trying to provide political stability, as has been noted, to the government and national unity and a range of others. It's engaging with Pakistan. It's encouraging relationships between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's engaging the rest of the region in terms of how they'll engage. It's engaging our partners so that they continue to stay involved, which they have done for over a decade now at our request. And then it's ultimately finding that negotiated political settlement with the Taliban and figuring out what the right table is and who is taking part in it and in what way and what's actually on the table. So all of that means there has to be an empowered State Department presence here, and I hope that we see some leadership from the State Department on that front, not just in terms of appointments among their senior leadership and who will ultimately own this, whether it's from one bureau or SRAP or a combination or however they ultimately decide to do it, but there has to be that role at the table driving this forward and being an equal voice in that decision making.
Yeah, if I can just add, so I think, you know, let me just add my voice to everyone who is indicating that diplomacy plays a critical role in this region as well as, you know, all over the world. And I think that, you know, we would be sorely mistaken to think that, you know, if we just let our military drive the process, you know, this will solve all our problems. That's absolutely incorrect. And, you know, I second what Dan has said about the importance of diplomacy. And, you know, this takes time, this takes resources, this takes, you know, a lot of handshakes and sitting across the room and talking. This is extremely critical. And if we need any, you know, evidence of that, I think we should look at what Russia's trying to do. I think what Russia is trying to assert a role in Afghanistan, despite the fact that they have no forces there, you know, very little aid, if any, programs, or, you know, they've had, you know, hardly any engagement there for several years. But yet they're trying to take advantage of our presidential transition and a period when they think we're not, you know, as focused on the region to try to assert a role there. And that's why they held these talks that included Iran, India, China, Afghanistan, Pakistan, you know, all the countries except for the U.S. I don't think they're going to be successful. I don't think they have leverage in the region. And, you know, I don't think they have a lot of support from the Afghan public at this point for taking on a critical role. But clearly they are trying to take advantage of, you know, they think we're distracted and they're taking advantage of that. And that only goes to the point more of why we do need the diplomatic political engagement and the important role that our State Department plays there.
I would add a comment on Track 2 because I take part in a lot of these, and Track 2 has lots of problems and is not a panacea by any means. However, I think one of the challenges between Pakistan and Afghanistan is a lack of understanding and a lack of sense of what things are like in the other country, particularly for Pakistanis looking at Afghanistan. And so to me, the promotion of Pakistan-Afghanistan Track 2 programs, bringing Pakistani journalists to Afghanistan to talk to Afghans, to see things. I mean, it can be very contentious and sometimes beyond contentious, but it'd be a very useful way to try and broaden understanding and broaden some, maybe create some channels of communication.
Marvin, could I just real quick?
Yes,
I know. I think track two, our dialogues are most effective when the governments have blessed kind of the content and the initiatives, and they're also focusing on those, and there's some added value that NGOs can bring. But I think in this case in particular, what Dan mentioned of regional meetings happening and Americans not being there, track twos can be very effective, and NGOs can be helpful in bringing out regional perspectives that we just might be missing out on. Second thing is, you know, let's not rely or 100% blame the generals for something they haven't done yet. I mean, they are part of our institution, right? They are one part of the U.S. government, and they themselves have relationships with the diplomats, with the State Department, with USAID. So if in fact the administration is leaning heavily on them, I think this is a situation where the institutions have to carry each other, right? And so I think we saw this during the Obama administration where State Department and Defense really, like, collaborated a lot on difficult issues, and Sec State and Sec Def would meet regularly, weekly, in fact, and that was a way to build an alliance. And so when I hear things like, you know, the State Department doesn't know the Mexican foreign minister is in town, I don't just blame the Trump administration, the core leadership. I'm wondering, why hasn't the NSC filtered this information through? What is behind that decision, right? So there's, again, this goes back to my comment about policy management. It becomes all the more important.
And in fact, the military has frequently championed that role because they recognize what it means over the long term, including General Mattis a number of years ago when he said, you know, if you don't send me the diplomats, then you ultimately have to send me more bullets. And we heard it as well, I think, from General Votel yesterday. Hopefully we will continue. This will be a reasoned decision. I would just say, combining all this. These are obviously unbelievably complex, difficult issues which have gone on for decades. We need every tool at our disposal in order to address those. And that, of course, means some military and intel and traditional security components, but it also means not only diplomatic and development, but people-to-people ties, economic ties, businesses, religious organizations, any number of others that you can marshal to bring in as part of an overarching comprehensive strategy needs to be part of it.
This gentleman. My name is Tariq, and I didn't introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Iqbal Tariq, and I have a question about Pakistan and China relationship. I'm not sure, we're just a little late. I'm not sure if you covered it. But CPEC factor, which is China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, I don't know how deep you are observing it, but it is actually, China's not trying to just wet its toes, but they're all the way deep up to their elbows as far as the Pakistan-China relationship is concerned. There's a huge investments going on in Pakistan, modernizing and expanding infrastructure.
Your question.
Yes. So given the isolationist and confrontational disposition of Trump with China, grown Pakistan-China relationship, how do you foresee Pakistan-U.S. relationship in perspective of growing China and Pakistan relationship?
Sure. I would just note that I think there was a phone call between President Trump and President Xi, and he acknowledged the One China policy. So I'm not sure that, you know, characterizing the China policy as confrontationalist, that we have a lot of data points to go on that at this point. And I would say it is still uncertain what the Trump administration China policy will be. That said, you're right, the CPEC is a major geopolitical, geoeconomic development in the region. China's investing $46 billion in energy projects and infrastructure projects. In Pakistan, this is, you know, you've had a traditionally close China-Pakistan relationship, but this adds a geoeconomic element to it. And I think the U.S. is supportive. I mean, to the extent that this helps with Pakistan's energy issues, its infrastructure problems, I think the U.S., you know, supports that if that's one of China's goals. And I do think that one of China's goals is economic development in Pakistan, trying to discourage Islamist extremism, promote stability. But a second goal is obviously very strategic, and getting access to the Gwadar port for access to energy supplies, the Arabian Sea. And, you know, that I think the U.S. needs to watch closely, whether or not China uses the port for military means or to project military power. You know, that would become a concern to the U.S. But what it means for the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, I don't think it means that much, honestly. I think there's two factors to that answer. One is that China also is concerned about Islamist extremist trends in the region, and I think that the issue of terrorism will come up. It has come up in the past in the Pakistan-China relationship, and it's bound to come up again. And so China, very broadly speaking, does share this concern with the U.S. So that's one reason. The second is, look, there is a long history of U.S.-Pakistan relations going back to the Cold War, and there's been a great deal of engagement, a lot of people-to-people ties, and, you know, everything we've been through, the bin Laden raid, the Salalah attack, I think would have absolutely upended any other bilateral relationship. But the fact that we've been able to weather some of these very difficult times, I think tells us that there is something deeper to the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And there are these people-to-people ties that I think are lacking, quite frankly, in the Pakistan-China relationship. So that gives me encouragement that in the long run, you will continue to see a strong partnership between the U.S. and Pakistan. And the democracy issue, too. I mean, look, yes, Pakistan is a struggling democracy, but there's still a great deal of support for democracy, democratic aspirations in the country, and the U.S., you know, is supportive of that. And so I think, you know, the civilian leadership in particular feels, you know, a kinship with America, and that will continue to remain very strong.
On that question, I think some of this will again be determined by what how the government continues, how the administration continues to mature. I think at this point we've still got almost kind of cartoonish, simplistic ideas of what their policies are going to be, which all seem to be kind of zero-sum games. So, you know, on China, they can be saber-rattling and talking to Taiwan and talking about a trade war starting and a range of other things, which certainly doesn't suggest that anyone that China considers an all-weather friend like Pakistan would be treated all that well. On the other hand, it's impossible for it to stay that way in as real-world events incur. And so, you know, as a case in point, with Secretary Tillerson about to head off, you know, on a trip to China, his first, you know, trip to Asia, to China, to talk about North Korea and to seek more from them and what can be done, how do you start balancing all the very many nuanced interests that we have? And I think thus far on in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they have seen this as this zero-sum game. I was one of those, you know, government representatives for many years that said, we do not consider CPEC a threat. It is exactly as Lisa said. These are things, they are doing things with this funding, which first of all, I question whether any Chinese commitment of $46 billion is even remotely that amount because of soft loans and kind of a range of other things using their own laborers. But even if it's half of $46 billion, that's a lot of money, three times more than we had for Kerry Lugar Berman. But interestingly, it's doing all the things that we sought to do with Kerry Lugar Berman in terms of energy development, infrastructure development, helping to build a middle class, and which ultimately leads to democracy promotion, help the government to deliver more for its citizens. These are things that are in our interest, which I firmly believe. I don't think that's the view of that was the view of this White House yet, because I'm not sure how much they've actually looked at that. And so the more that they have to start putting this in a broader picture with other interests at play, we'll have to see where that develops.
Ambassador, you
Yeah, my Rick Olson, another former SRAP. my question is for Lisa. I fully agree with the analysis on, as you put it, the duality of Pakistan policy towards terrorism. The question is, when we address that, what do you think, and you sort of got into this, but what do you think is the basis for U.S. leverage? Having dealt with this myself quite a bit, I'm not convinced that we think that we have as much leverage as we think we do, especially how do we overcome what Pakistan would see as a core strategic interest. It's not something that's fungible for them. It is really, I think, a core strategic interest to be able to shape events in Afghanistan to their liking.
Okay. No, I would agree with you that it's very difficult and that we may at times overestimate our leverage, but I still would hold that we haven't utilized fully that leverage. And I think the Obama administration in the tail end, the last, you know, 6 to 8 months, did start exercising some of that leverage, mainly, you know, led by U.S. congressional actions, the U.S. Congress holding up U.S. funding for the purchase of F-16s, as well as holding back $300 million in coalition support funds. So, you know, I think we had started down the path of enforcing conditions that had long been on the aid. They just hadn't been enforced. The Obama administration chose to use its national security waiver authority for many years. So, you know, to give a specific, I think that, you know, the administration should, you know, lay out its expectation that it does expect Pakistan to take certain steps on the Haqqani network, on the Taliban, maybe lay out a few steps that it feels is doable, that we assess that Pakistan could actually do this without, you know, a tremendous amount of blowback. It's something that could be done, and then give a certain period of time. And if that's not done, then okay, then maybe we withdraw the major non-NATO ally status. So that's one step. But I think you have to be willing to, you know, take these steps and not be fearful that the minute you you know, do something that is negative, that you're going to have, you know, a blow up in the relationship, or because I think that Pakistan is capable of doing more than it's doing. So I don't think it's purely a capacity issue. It may be partly a capacity issue, but certainly we should be expecting more. And, you know, frankly, we've seen some positive steps. Pakistan put under house arrest Hafiz Mohammed Saeed, the leader of the LET, something that it hadn't done in several years. You know, this is a step in the right direction. Sending the Rangers into southern Punjab to take on some of the terrorists in that region, you know, also a good step. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are things that we should expect, and we shouldn't be afraid to exercise some of our leverage. And, you know, that is just my firm opinion, that we should expect more on these issues, and that it's not impossible. And, you know, if you look at, you know, there's just been this very unhelpful stance toward terrorism. There has been an, you know, inability or a choice to let certain terrorists out of jail, for instance, that have then gone on to commit acts of terrorism against U.S. forces in Afghanistan or Afghan forces. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we need to see stop, and that, you know, are not a capacity issue. It's completely within Pakistan's ability to do something about it. And I think we just need to press these, you know, press these home more. I think the major problem was right after 9/11 in assessing that in order to get Pakistan's cooperation on Al-Qaeda, we had to turn a blind eye to their support to the Taliban and other groups. I think that was a fundamental miscalculation, a misunderstanding that these groups operate together and they feed each other and, you know, they train together and they have the same ideologies. So you can't hope to crack down on one and expect to, you know, still have control on the others, you know, if you let them continue to operate. And unfortunately, I think Pakistan is seeing this blowback itself in the form of, you know, more and more attacks against the Pakistani state. So I think it's in Pakistan's own interest to come up with a comprehensive strategy toward the terrorist problem and take on that ideology that is fueling all of the groups.
Yeah, two quick things. First of all, I agree with Lisa's first part where she talks essentially about trade-offs, that any kind of national security policy involves trade-offs. In the case of U.S.-Pakistan, there's enormous amount of trade-offs. And the U.S. has been hesitant to pursue some of those shorter-term goals because of the trade-offs on longer-term engagement, I would say, right? Nuclear engagement, we need a partnership with the Pakistanis. But at the same time, we've done certain things that do call that strategy into question. We killed Osama bin Laden. We killed Mullah Mansour, right? So those were two instances of where the U.S. was very capable of doing something and did and took action. And what was the blowback? There was some. And the relationship historically or moving forward will have to kind of bear the burden of taking those actions. But I would shift the focus away from Pakistan's ability to our ability. What are we capable of? And what are we willing to do? And in that, if you look at it in that sense, I actually think the field is a little bit more wide open. And for example, go after the Afghan Taliban leadership. I mean, that's a serious question, and it's not easy to answer. But what if the United States said, okay, well, we're going to approach this issue, and what are we going to be more aggressive about? If, in fact, that's what we care about, we don't want them in Quetta. I mean, we've been through these questions. I know it's not easy to answer, but I do think we have to look at what are we capable of and what are we willing to digest.
Jamal is referring to the fact that we really tied our hands behind our back when it comes to the Afghan Taliban operating in Balochistan. And even the rules of engagement inside Afghanistan have been ones that did not treat the Taliban the same way that we were attacking, certainly Islamic State and the Haqqani network. And so there was that killing of Mansour, but it was nothing beyond that. I know Rick Olson has some views on that, but we won't. Okay, I'm going to take a final question down here. Yours is the first hand.
So Dana Marshall with Transnational Strategy Group. In the spirit of this discussion, I came into the room sort of zero-basing my thinking. and listening very carefully about one particular area of this very wide discussion, which is why do we continue to battle the Taliban? And probably the clearest answer was from Lisa, which is that there is a demonstration effect. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing what you were saying, but if that is what you're saying, and I'd be interested to know a quick answer about why are we at war with them today, that if it is a demonstration effect, could there also be a negative demonstration that after 16 years, the world's radical Islamic fighters see that we have not been able to defeat them, and that they're taking, in a sense, a negative example of our powerlessness to do that? Should we not be a little bit more careful about what we try to do if the point is a demonstration point?
Yeah, no, I think I've made my point that I think it's fundamentally in the U.S. national security interest that the Taliban are not able to retake that country because they will, you know, open the doors for international terrorists to take root yet again. We'll be back to square one, back to where we were on September 10th, 2001, and opening ourselves up for future attacks. So that's one reason. The second is, as you spelled out, the demonstration effect. And I think what you said is two sides of the same coin and further argues my point that if we are not successful and, you know, at least pushing the Taliban back and forcing them to come into some kind of political solution rather than letting them win militarily, then we're going to have bigger problems on our hands. And I would posit that we would be back in the region anyway in the future. You know, we've seen this movie play out. You know, I've been following this region for 25 years. I saw how we turned our backs on the region after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan. And I think that that certainly did contribute to the terrorism problem growing in the region. And eventually, you know, the Taliban giving shelter to bin Laden and allowing a platform from which the 9/11 attacks were conducted. I think there is still a relationship there, and we ignored it at our own peril. I think, you know, assuming that the Taliban is an equal player to the current Afghan government is a big mistake. I mean, the Afghan officials that we're dealing with now are very much partners. You know, the Taliban are still partnering with the international terrorists that are seeking to attack us.
Any last comments here from Jack?
Yeah, just one. The gentleman asked about the China-Pakistan economic corridor, and I was going to add that to me, one of the things that would be very beneficial is to see some connectivity between that and Afghanistan. And so far, that has not, although you occasionally get some sort of airy remarks about how that's a great idea, there's nothing concrete. And yet, that would be very beneficial for Afghanistan. It would seem to me be beneficial for Pakistan to tie into Central Asia. But some connectivity developed between the CPEC North-South going more towards the Northwest as well through Chaman to Kandahar, through in the northern droughts as well from Pakistan to Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, I would just say, I mean, I think that basically leaves us directly exactly where we started, which is, you know, we have to define and identify and assert what our interests in the region actually are. And is part of that that we are at war with the Taliban? There are many who would say, including the Vice President Biden said sometimes, we are not at war with the Taliban. Obviously, our troops and resources continue to face threat streams emanating from the Taliban, and so we are there and take defensive action when necessary. But because we've ended our combat mission, we are there only doing training, advising, assisting for the Afghan National Security Forces and this more limited counterterrorism front. But it does mean, so are we there because of ISIL and Daesh, because of al-Qaeda, because of Taliban, so that it doesn't turn into a failed state and whatever that may mean, once again. But I think it goes back to that overarching theme, which is that, you know, as I remember General Petraeus first stating, and I think virtually every NATO commander since then, there is not a military solution. You are not going to kill every Taliban in Afghanistan. They are part of the Afghan societal fabric. And so the only long-term resolution is trying to engage in some sort of political negotiated settlement, which brings them back into that fabric of society in some way, whether as a political party in some sort of representative fashion, whatever it may be. But they are not going to disappear from the face of Afghanistan or the earth. And for that to happen, there has to be a prominence of diplomacy, and there has to be American leadership.
Just one, we, or Lisa, I think, alluded to the 90s narrative, and we're here passing notes about that, too, and it gets invoked in conversations. I think it's important to remember the history on the Taliban and the response that the U.S. took after 9/11 and where we're at today. But when we look at the 90s narrative, we should think critically about it and think about what aspects of the situation at the time enabled that, and what has changed now. And we've been in the region for a long time, too, and we have partnerships, as Lisa mentioned, and there's been institution building, and we've gone through a lot together with these countries. So I think that we have to be forward-looking, and part of the challenge has been that we're haunted by the past, and rightfully so, but it just reinforces kind of my initial comment that it's a good time to review who the enemy is, define that, what are we actually fighting?
And, with that thought in mind, to ask the question about how useful is it to differentiate among the insurgents at this point? In some ways, it's become a seamless organization. And so to draw the distinction about perhaps legally they are our enemies and they are not our enemies, we accuse Pakistan of doing that all the time. But in a way, we've done it, too, for our own reasons, and as they did for theirs. Well, look, we could go on with this for some time. This, I'm sure you share my feeling here, that this is a wonderful panel. And a program is only as good as its panelists, and we've done well here. So let's give them a hand.
Questionnaire,
it would take you about 30 seconds to complete. If you would look at it.